Good morning, everybody. I would like to call this meeting to order and begin by acknowledging that we are in Mi'kma'ki, the traditional territory of the Mi'kmaq people. Are there any announcements, acknowledgements, or recognitions? Councillor Greek.
Thanks, Councillor Moore. I just want to take a moment and recognize Kathy and her team for the awesome work. No, Canada Day in New Germany was awesome. It's nice to come back. Last year, it was a little smaller. Kathy dedicated a whole year with her team of organizing this, bringing so many people to the community, highlighting businesses, organizations, people. It was incredible. She did a lot of work and rounded up a lot of volunteers to make the day happen. And thank you, Kathy.
Thank you. Wow. Thank you, Michelle. But like I said, as the chair of a committee, you get to delegate. So I got a lot of good workers I delegate to. Mayor Bolifagetson?
I guess just to piggyback on that, I attended a lot of Canada Day festivities throughout the municipality. And I will say that it was a very good day in many of the communities throughout. So, again, hats off to all the volunteers who put a lot of time and effort into the celebrations that were held on Canada Day.
Thank you. Any more announcements? Hearing none, I'll ask if there's anybody here for public input. Nope. Approval of the minutes of June 6, 2023. Moved by Councillor DeLong. I have to approve the agenda. Where is that? Oh, number four. Motion to approve the agenda. Moved by Councillor Deputy Mayor Hubley, seconded by Councillor Haysom. All those in favor? Motion carried unanimously. Now we will do the approval of the minutes of June 6, 2023. Moved by Councillor DeLong, seconded by Councillor Oigle. Any discussion? Ready for the question. All those in favor? Motion carried unanimously. And it's not 9:15, but, well, it's 9:14, so close enough to 9:15 that we can have our presentation from the New Elm Church, Allie Mailman Church Committee President. Would you like to come forward?
Good morning, guys. I just want to let you know first, I wear a hearing aid, so if I don't hear somebody, reach at me, please. And I'm super nervous, so take it easy on me. Okay, so, yeah, I'm coming from the New Elm Church. We are having some problems with our roof right now, and we need some help repairing the roof. So that's why I'm here. So I'll start with the first slide. So our use of our church is basically for church and funeral services. But with the times, you know, people aren't into church, the younger generations, as much as they were. So although we have those older generations that do use our church as a church and services and for funerals, we also use it as a hub of the community. So we're using it for parties for kids, birthday parties. We're using it for craft nights, paint nights, meeting spaces. We're also using it for just general social gatherings for our church. Many churches in the communities are being turned over as alternate sites, you know, housing. I've seen churches turned into a garage. I've seen churches turned into art studios, things like that. We want to maintain our church as a social gathering for just the community. We also bring in other communities when we're doing these nights. Our alternate activities are actually more successful than church, to be honest. People from all around come to those alternate communities. Am I allowed to change the slide, Tina? Okay. So this is us just gathering. There's usually food no matter what we do because everybody likes food. But this is just us every day using it for whatever. So this is the state of the roof. We are structurally sound to the best of my knowledge, but the actual roof, the shingles, as you can see, are in disrepair. They're curling at the moment. They're falling off literally every day. Any bit of wind, we're losing shingles. June has been exceptionally hard for us because we have a small leak in the roof. It's around one of the light fixtures. We're constantly emptying that light fixture. We have turned off the power so that we have no chance of electrical issues, anything like that. Oops, sorry. So I've contacted contractors, many contractors, and the last time I was here to speak about the change of the going from asphalt to metal, Councillor Martin Bell brought up the point of checking out some tile options. Well, I have. And I've contacted 12 to 13 people between HRM and the surrounding sites. And no one but two people, so I guess it's not no one, two people, their companies will do this. However, the cost of their companies to do this is double or 2.5 times what we've quoted regular steel. We feel that we can't afford that at this time. So we've contacted Walls primarily. And for labor and materials, they're coming in at $12,265.79. That includes getting rid of the waste, setting up, everything. Any occurrences that might occur just from routine, doing the roof, like strapping, things like that. MC Hammers is also a local company. And for the same thing, they've come in at $12,075. Now, the differences between those two companies is option A, who we think we should go with, Walls. Their metal is slightly thicker. They're 26 gauge, whereas option B is 29 gauge. And they offer a 5-year, Walls does, offers a 5-year warranty on their materials and labor, whereas MC Hammer does not. So those are the two quotes we're coming up with. So our available funds. We've been fundraising since December of 2022. So we've done the memorial tree lighting, which raised quite a bit of money. We've raffled off a donated item. We've done a penny auction, which was hugely successful at over $3,000 right there. And we've been acquiring donations. As the community knows, we are in dire need, and we've been posting this on social media and everything like that, that we need donations to help this little church. So our whole budget for this roof project is $6,265.75. That's from just the church. So what we need to make this a reality, we need more money. So we currently don't have enough money to pay for the roof and continue operating. We don't want to change the structure or anything of that roof because it is a heritage building. We want to keep it in that state. We just want to change the material from asphalt to metal, which council has approved. And this roof is not the current roof. It's been replaced many times. So what we're asking from you guys is technically less than 50%, if you put it that way. We're asking for $6,000, and that's to help the other portion of covering with the labor and materials. So if you do the math, like I said, we're requesting option A, Walls, minus the $6,000 from council, equals the $62.65 and $0.75 that the church can provide. And that is all. So that's from the New Elm Church, guys. I'm your contact, Allie Mailman. I'm the president of the committee. And there's my phone number, my email address. If you want to reach out in any way, please reach out. Any questions?
Thanks, Allie. Okay, so I have Councillor Staton, Mayor Bolifer Getson, DeLong, and two over here. Councillor Staton.
Thank you. Thank you, Allie, for your presentation. I just have two questions for you. And the metal roof that you're putting on, is that to cover the existing roof, or will that be stripped down and just the metal roof on the building? Do you know that?
It's going to just cover. They're going to put strapping.
And cover the existing?
Yes.
Okay. The other question I have is, do you receive money from the diocesan of the church? I don't know what denomination you are.
We're a union church.
Union church. So there's no main church somewhere that you get money from?
No, we do not. We are our own entity.
Okay.
And everything that we've raised everything. We don't have outside. Now, I will be honest. I didn't mention this. We are pending a donation, a large donation coming up, but that hasn't been included in this because we need that for operating.
Thank you.
Mayor Bolifer Getson?
I guess that was one of my questions, Allie, when you said the funds available. Was that going to exhaust your current bank account by doing that?
No.
Because there will be operating funds needed. And you have applied for a grant, I believe?
Yes, and been denied.
Okay. I guess under our grant policy, churches are ineligible. As such, when they're basically used only for church. This building, I will say, is definitely used for more than that, as you have indicated here. It is the community focal point. There is not a community hall in the New Elm area, and it does have the opportunities that you have said to be used for birthday parties, whatever. So it definitely is a building that would like to see it preserved for the future generations to come. And it's great to see that the community have all come out in support of the application as well. So I guess as far as questions, basically I wanted to know that there was other money that would be able to be used to keep the building running after that fact.
Yes.
And without a roof, you don't have anything.
No. May I interrupt?
Sure.
Other than the roof, the interior of the building is impeccable. It's very well preserved. Like I said, there is one, maybe two small leaks, but that has not hindered the inside of the building one bit.
Okay, thank you, Allie. Councillor DeLong.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your presentation.
Thank you.
That you actually just answered my question about the interior of the building, so that's good to know. I can see from the pictures that the state of the roof is in pretty urgent need. What kind of time frame are you looking to get this accomplished in?
We would like to have it done by fall.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
The sooner the better.
Yes.
Okay, Councillor Oigle, then Councillor Deputy Mayor Hubley.
Yeah, I just have two questions through the chair. One is, I don't know which grants that you applied for, but were they heritage grants from the federal or provincial government? Because you are a heritage site, right?
Mm-hmm.
Have you looked into that?
They were not heritage. Federally, I looked into that. And I was under the assumption from Ken Barrett from Halifax, when I looked into the provincial grants, he stated that we would not qualify for federal funding for this particular option. Provincially, he also said there's not much out there for this particular case. He said you need to go to your municipality, rather.
Okay. And my other question is, do you have plans to fix those leaks once the roof has been done? Like, do you have funds set aside to be able to fix those leaks?
Yes, most definitely.
Okay.
Thank you. Deputy Mayor Hubley? So the New Elm Church is a registered heritage property built in 1906. This is a small but mighty group attempting to maintain the heritage status. And they have their work cut out for them. This church has a ton of sentimental value to the people in the community and the surrounding communities. For some residents, memories of going to church there as a child carry hurdles was married there in 1993, and then her daughter married there in 2021. So there's a ton of memories and stories wrapped right around this. I support the ask, and I also hope councillors around the table will too.
Thank you. Is there any more questions? Councillor Bell.
I just have a comment to Ms. Melman through you, Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
Ms. Melman, I appreciate the fact that when you came, you brought other interested people with you. That shows interest. The fact that you have a petition signed shows effort.
I've been here before.
And when I had suggested alternate roofing, I was not aware that it was going to be that much difference. I seem to remember it was a little bit of difference when Riverport did it, but things change over the years. But I do appreciate you following up on that. Thank you.
Anyone else? Thank you, Ali. As our organization, how we handle things, there's no decisions made right here today. It will go back to staff, and then recommendations will be made to get it on another agenda probably.
Okay. We realize that.
Councillor Greig.
Do we have a timeline that we could provide to Ali? Will it get on before the August break?
Yes.
Excellent.
Okay. Thank you.
With minimal disruption, mm-hmm. are we allowed to sneak out?
Yes.
And, thank you.
And you don't have to sneak.
Thank you for your time, guys.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. And you've done very well, Ali.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Now we go down to 10.1.1 from the Finance Department Operating Variance Report, fourth quarter draft to March 31st, 2023. And we have Elena, our Director of Finance.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. You're used to seeing these every quarter. This is your fourth quarter draft operating fund variance report for March 31st, 2023. So we've enclosed comments on the forecast variances. Right now we're looking at about $2.8 million in surplus, which is 7.94% budget variance. $2.4 million of that is actually detransfer tax and interest on deposits over budget. So the expenditure variance is $344,000, less than budgeted. If the committee wishes, I can go through it page by page, or I will take questions. It's up to the committee.
Okay. Do you want to just, I'm sure you all read it thoroughly. So are there any questions? Councillor Statton.
I'm full of them this morning. surplus, does that go in operating or does it go in capital reserve? Where do you put the surplus?
The surplus is legislated by the MGA, and it goes in an operating reserve. So we call that our general operating reserve. So sometimes you'll see that on your capital funding sheets as general operating. Yeah.
Okay. Any more questions? Councillor Haysom.
Thanks so much. I'm just sort of looking at the police protection and the variance on the RCMP contract, and given what we're expecting around RCMP costs, I'm just wondering if you could speak to that a little bit.
Okay, certainly. So police protection shows about $24,000 budget variance. I budgeted $3.9 million. It came in at $3.895. So what happens with the police protection contract, we get an estimate from the Department of Justice, and that's what we use to budget, and then we get an actual, usually after the budget's passed or close to when the budget's passed. So it's our understanding that, you know, the numbers they're giving us are adequate. I know there was a discussion about those past service costs on their contract, and the province of Nova Scotia has not passed that cost on to the municipal units that have contracts with the province for RCMP at this time.
Okay. Anybody else for a question? Okay, well, that is, thank you for your presentation. And now we are going to Administration Department 10.2.1, noise concerns and short-term rentals. And we have our Deputy CAO, Alex DeMeritt.
Morning, committee members.
Morning.
So this is a follow-up from the discussion last month generally around a noise bylaw. Just to refresh the committee's memory, there wasn't an appetite to continue to examine a noise bylaw in general, but there were continuing concerns about noise concerns or noise issues generated by short-term rentals. So staff went back and did a little bit more information. I give a big nod to the planning department for assisting. They had some background research done, and also Zanders Wicker provided some assistance here as well. So I'm just going to run through it quickly so that council or the committee can have a bit of a discussion on the topic. To provide some background context, the rise of short-term rentals has created significant issues across the country. It's not just something that we're dealing with locally. So it is having a major impact on housing markets across the country. Sorry, is there a question? No?
I don't think so.
Okay. I'm happy to take questions as we go. With the rise of companies like VRBO and Airbnb, there's been increased opportunities for individuals to let out their houses on a short-term basis. However, research from the CMHC suggests that while these companies portray these businesses as individuals, for example, sharing a room in their home, it's not actually the case. So the majority of short-term rentals are actually owned by large corporations. Just as an example, HRM did some research into this. The top 10% of hosts in that municipality make 55% of all the revenue. So it looks like, you know, someone's renting out a vacation home or that type of thing. It's actually large companies that have multiple units that they are renting, and it's a profit-generating exercise. So in addition to the issues created around housing stock, where there are short-term rentals, there are persistent issues found both around noise, but also increasingly communities having issues actually building community bonds because permanent residency is on the decline. To illustrate that a little bit more, the planning department gathered a little bit of statistics. Oh, my gosh. Also, Ruth, our tourism officer has pulled together some information as well in preparation for the marketing levy, and I'd be remiss not to acknowledge her help here as well. So you can see on the graph there, this is rental units available in MODL, in entire units, so this doesn't count if you are letting out a room in a home. And you can see 81% of those are long-term rental units, 19% are short-term rental units. We actually have the second highest rate in the province of short-term rental units, and the growth, this is happening across the province, but especially in MODL, the growth of those short-term units is far outstripping those long-term units. So we're seeing this in terms of, you know, just municipal staff. We're hiring folks, and they're trying to find places to rent, and they can't. And one of the driving factors behind that is this increase in that green piece of the pie where full units are becoming available for short-term rentals because they're generating greater profit for the owners. Just in terms of volume, the highest, it varies according to season and month by month. Every year, the number of short-term units are increasing. So our peak was last September. There were 292 units available for short-term rental. Just a little bit of history on provincial regulation. So back in 2019, a Department of Business report identified that there was a need for short-term rentals to help fill a gap in tourism accommodations. One of the outcomes of that report was a change to provincial regulations, essentially deregulating a good portion of tourism accommodation. So we've seen this impact come as we've seen issues with campgrounds, for example. Another impact was around requirements for licensing for fixed roof accommodation. So they removed the need to license for a short-term rental unit. They also changed the way that they were taxed, and there was a full exemption from fees for smaller properties. Now, this wasn't ownership. It was just the unit itself. So if it was under four rooms, then it was exempt from fees. I think there was some acknowledgement that this did create some issues, so the province has amended that legislation. The Tourism Accommodation Registration Act now does require all short-term rentals to register, and that was effective as of this spring.
So the Tourist Accommodation Act, this isn't the one that they repealed, I assume. This is a new?
Tourism Accommodation Registration Act.
Ah, okay.
So whereas the previous one included licensing, standards, inspections,
yes.
This is a registration act
okay,
only.
Okay, thank
yep.
you.
So it doesn't address those issues around campgrounds, but it does at least capture all of those units that have gone from long-term rentals into short-term but weren't registered.
That also include, like, if a person rents out one bedroom in their house?
That, yeah. I'd have to double check on that. I guess my memory is a bit hazy from the long weekend.
Okay.
So the data that we gathered for you here relates specifically to whole units because we were looking at housing stock. I'll have to double check so that I don't misspeak whether or not the registration requirement applies for a single room within a dwelling. So coming down to the municipal level, there are two main avenues where the municipality could engage with some type of regulatory authority for short-term rentals. The first is your minimum planning requirements. So as you know, we're required to put in comprehensive land use planning. You do have the option to put in rules around short-term rentals or home-based businesses, which could qualify, for example, if you're letting out a room or two within a full dwelling. It should be noted that you can't simply provide a blanket prohibition. You can't say no short-term rentals whatsoever, but you can, for example, identify what zones they could go in, and you can create different systems to limit some of the potential conflicting uses that might happen. The other avenue is through the Municipal Government Act. So in Section 172, it creates the authority for the municipality to use bylaws to regulate business activities. So this would allow you to define what a business activity is and then establish a licensing regime for it, and then you could have conditions for holding a license.
Mayor Balbogetson. But again, existing properties that are registered as short-term rentals would be exempt or grandfathered, would they not, if we created a zone after the fact?
Under land use planning, yes. So you end up with a non-conforming use. So you create a zone and you say no short-term rentals in this area, but if there is an existing short-term rental unit, then it would be allowed to continue.
Mm-hmm.
It just couldn't have additional ones added to it. If you were to create a licensing regime, that would apply to any business, whether they were planning on opening or whether they were operating today.
Okay, Councillor Bina, then Councillor Hazem.
Trying to wrap my head around this bylaws to regulate business activities.
Yep.
You mentioned it won't go backwards, but if somebody was to amend or to put more units on a property, would that bylaws prevent them from expansion?
So there are two different sources of regulation. The land use planning can't go backwards. You can't retroactively say you can't do this use anymore. If you were to create a licensing regime, it would apply to existing businesses. So if someone's in the business of providing tourism accommodation, you decide that you want to license all tourism accommodation in your municipality, all businesses in that business activity would have to get a license and comply with the conditions, regardless of whether they were operating before you created that regime.
Follow up to that?
Sure.
And that is a bylaw that this council could look at making. That's in the Municipal Government Act that we
mm-hmm.
can do that. Thank you.
So I do have a little more information on it. It might help to finish those unless there's a specific question.
Sure, I'll just ask quickly because I think it's probably straightforward. If you want to regulate an activity or business, do you have to establish a licensing regime? Like, can you? I'm thinking about how much workload that creates for the, you know, for staff, right? Or just for the municipality, it just becomes a lot of red tape. So can you say, like, listen, you can do A, B, C, D. Doesn't mean you necessarily need to come in and apply for a license in order to do so or to have an exemption or what have you. I'm just wondering, is it like, does one require, they're not mutually exclusive.
So if you decide to regulate a business activity, you're in that business. So you will, that will be an increased workload. That's one of the issues that we're about to get to.
Councillor Eichel.
And can we establish what the length of time for a short-term rental is considered or and a long-term rental?
Generally, the definition is under 28 days. So they look at like a monthly lease. The shortest month of the year is 28 days. So anything under 28 days is considered a short-term rental. And most other regulatory regimes that I've looked at and other pieces of legislation, it's defined the same way.
Okay. Councillor Bell. And then we'll leave Alex to continue.
When we're advancing to the next stage, there's one fact I want to mention about the provincial government that they leave off. That's short-term rentals collect GST, which is forwarded to the government by the rental hosting companies. They always forget to leave that fact off. So when you hear larger municipalities like HRM complaining about short-term rentals, they can do so because they collect no revenue other than the property taxes. Mm-hmm. But when the province talks about it, they tell you some of the negative facts, but they forget to leave the fact out that they're profiting off of this. Mm-hmm. The second thing I want to mention is that the province has created the atmosphere to have building owners go to long-term to short-term due to the total mess of the Residential Tenancies Act and the board. Mm-hmm. Because if you talk to the landlords, many of them find that their hands are tied with being able to manage their property where they are facing increased insurance. But, for example, I was talking to one owner just recently who said that his insurance costs went up 15% this year. But he can only raise it, I think, 3% to the tenants in the same year. So he is absorbing the costs. Not only that, the cost of the maintenance for those buildings. So now some of the buildings are becoming in disrepair because the landlord can't put in the money and the investment that should be going into the building, which I think over the long term will lead to issues such as fire safety issues where a staircase from a second floor may not be replaced when it should or normally would. Hmm. So I think they need to have all agencies involved when they're regulating these things because we're driving some business owners into going to this short-term rental where otherwise they may not be in that business. Mm-hmm. So I just want us to be able to look at all the facts, and if we're going to do some type of regulation, I think it would be important to include landlords in this just to have their input on how they see it, and some owners of short-term rentals as well, because I think in order to get the clearest picture for us to be making the best decision, we need to talk to everybody that's involved in this scenario. Thank you.
Okay.
So just looking at some of the approaches that have been taken in other jurisdictions, you have a range of options that are available if you want to look at some type of regulation on short-term rentals. So there are examples across the country where, for example, in Nelson, BC, they've broken down their municipality into regions, and then they limit the number of licenses available by region. So this creates a cap on the number of short-term units that would be available, which in theory creates more space for those long-term rentals. Other approaches to try and keep the operations down to smaller corporations as escalating the licensing fee. So as you consolidate properties into a single company, the licensing fees escalate for those for the per unit. Some jurisdictions which are experiencing like huge boom in expansion of short-term rental units have eliminated the possibility of renting short-term units unless it's an owner occupied. So they're trying to get away from wholesale rental of condo buildings, for example, as Airbnbs, sort of like shadow hotels. There are obviously some enforcement issues with it, but the City of Toronto is pursuing this and is attempting to eliminate those kinds of situations. And then a modified version of this, which might be more appropriate for a rural setting, is limiting it to if the primary residence is on the same lot. So you could have multiple units, but the owner of the property is living right there. Interesting side effect of that is that if there are issues with those short-term renters, that the owner is experiencing those issues themselves. just to reiterate a point already made, you can't use land use planning or business licensing to eliminate something. You can't create a system where it's not permitted whatsoever. Even beyond the legal issues, I don't think that's something that would be recommended for the municipality, given that short-term rentals are a source of economic activity for us, particularly where we promote the tourism sector, and they are a necessary feature for the tourism sector. So the direct question that the committee asked was, can you create a noise bylaw just for Airbnbs? And the short answer is no. However, if you were to pursue a licensing approach, you would then define what counts as a short-term rental. So this would include, you could include, for example, event venues or short-term rentals or both, and you would require them to have a license. And along with a license comes conditions for that business to continue to operate. That's how you achieve the regulation of the business. So that could include, for example, establishing quiet periods, and you would then be able to levy fines on individuals that were violating the conditions of their license, and ultimately, if there were repeated violations, you could revoke that license itself. So it's not a noise bylaw, but it would have a similar effect. That's why there's the asterisk next to the no, you can't create a noise bylaw just for Airbnbs. The reality, though, is if it, you know, walks like a duck and looks like a duck, it is a duck. So you haven't created a noise bylaw just for Airbnbs. You've created a licensing regime, which has the same effect, which means you're going to have the same enforcement questions. Mm-hmm. So as we saw last month, we were looking at estimated costs of roughly $250,000 a year for operating costs for an enforcement mechanism. You would expect something in the similar range because you're still looking at the same type of staff complement required to provide that kind of enforcement. You still have the same issues around securing enforcement, so some of the legal challenges that we address, some of the concerns around how do you create a credible case for prosecution, and then how do you deal with some of the issues around the court system and getting municipal prosecutions on their docket. And then you have the further issue, as Councillor Haysom has pointed out, that you've now created a licensing regime. So you're in the business of licensing that business activity. You have to maintain the process for applying for the license. You have to maintain the process of whatever types of inspections that might come along with this. And unfortunately, you will then have opened up a whole new dimension for which folks might come to you with concerns. Whereas right now, if someone has an issue with their Airbnb rental, perhaps they address it with the host, perhaps they address it with the company VRBO or Airbnb. Now there's a license. There's a municipal license for them to operate, so they have a new avenue to complain.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I have Councillor DeLong and then Councillor Haysom.
Thank you, Chair. Alex, do you mind pointing at the laptop down? Thanks, just so I can see you. You referenced some of the challenges, enforcement and whatnot. When you were doing your scan across Canada, did you come across challenges that other municipalities had overcome?
I wouldn't say overcome. You take, for example, Toronto, a huge amount of short-term rental properties. They passed this new legislation where it had to be a primary residence, so you have to demonstrate that you live there 181 days of the year. That's certainly reduced the number of short-term rentals, but has not eliminated it. And so there's all sorts of creative approaches people are taking to try and establish the requirements that they need to be able to rent a unit on a short-term basis through the city system, or circumventing that and waiting till they get caught, which takes quite some time, and then paying the fine and renting it again. Hmm. So I think we would experience some of those similar challenges. I'm not aware of someone that has created a system which didn't create extra administrative burden and didn't have the enforcement issues.
Supplementary.
Thank you. So if we were to enact something along these lines, we have an understanding of how much it would cost and how much work it would take. Do we know how much housing stock it might free up to have a licensing or bylaw approach?
So just a cautionary note, we've given you a sort of order of magnitude. We don't actually know how much it would cost or how difficult it would be, because we haven't put in the effort to do that. We've given you a sort of snapshot, so that you would need to, as Councillor Bell has pointed out, there's some significant consultation that you would need to undertake before you developed a licensing regime. So you would want to be consulting not just with the folks that own those units, but other stakeholders that might be affected, whether those are landlords, tenants associations, the general public. You're probably going to want to have some detailed interaction with the provincial tourism and business departments, that type of stuff. So we haven't developed work plans for those. We're explaining to you the regulatory environment and what the possibilities are. But there's an awful lot more work if you want to head down that direction. So that didn't answer your question. Can you ask it for me again?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, go ahead, because I don't think he understood your ask.
No, I did. I just wanted to make sure that it was...
Yeah, no, I think you just went down a rabbit hole away from the question.
So, just having said that, we don't actually know how much it will cost.
But
the data shows us that we have approximately 300 units. We can expect more this year. These are full unit rentals, so this isn't counting the partial units.
Mm-hmm.
And we have, that's 19% of the whole unit stock that's currently available. Now, I don't think that you can assume that if you create a licensing regime that restricts the amount of units, they will all become long-term units. Some of them are seasonal units. Some of them aren't appropriate for long-term rental, so you won't see a one-to-one conversion. But you would expect some benefit in terms of increasing long-term rental stock.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Councillor Haysom?
Thank you. So this is really interesting, because we're kind of having two different conversations here. One was the noise bylaw, which is how we got down this path, and the other is the issue of our housing stock and long-term or short-term rentals. So it seems to me that we're using the wrong, we're going about trying to address a noise bylaw issue without addressing a noise bylaw issue and instead getting lost in a short-term rental issue. Maybe I'm off base here, but this is how I'm interpreting it. If we say that creating some kind of licensing for short-term rentals and applying licenses through the municipality and the sort of cost and time and staff requirements that that will look will require of us, if that's comparable to having a noise bylaw, why not just have a noise bylaw, which allows you to address issues around noisy Airbnb rentals, but also maybe people who continually have loud events or, you know, some of the other noise bylaw issues that we're not super comfortable getting into. It's just if the cost is the same, why not actually do the thing that we are talking about as opposed to creating a whole licensing and regulatory framework for short-term rentals?
Thanks. I think that's an excellent point. You know, the committee asked specifically, can we address and it becomes a broader discussion because you have a housing question and you have a noise question. So you have both of those there. Unfortunately, it doesn't look like it would be cheaper to try and target noise emanating from short-term rentals. And it is not. And it doesn't avoid the enforcement issues. There's a marginal increase because of the licensing requirement, but the challenges in terms of securing enforcement remain.
I have Councillor Oigle, then Mayor Balavagas, and then Councillor Vino.
Okay, so my question has nothing to do with the noise. It has to do with short-term rentals. I don't think 19% is a lot for out of the 100. And I would be interested to know in other communities, other municipalities, what that ratio is as well, to see whether it's a norm or if it's low or high or
it's
whatever.
It's high. We're the second highest.
We're the second highest for the Atlantic provinces or for Nova Scotia?
For Nova Scotia.
For Nova Scotia. Okay. All right. Thank you.
And Mayor Balavagas.
I just want to go back to get people back on focus here. We asked staff to go back and look at whether or not we could have a noise bylaw for short-term rentals only. That's how we got to where we are today talking about short-term rentals. I guess what I'm hearing is that there wouldn't be a lot of cost difference whether we implemented a noise bylaw or whether if we could have went this route, the registration system is going to be expensive as well. So we ask staff to go here. Because my understanding at the last meeting was that we didn't feel that we wanted to go the other route. So we were trying to make it more specific to where the issue actually has been, and most of that issue has been around short-term rentals. And it's climbing, and it's understandable when you look at we have 292, I believe it is, short-term rentals in our municipality. Now, there was questions around here whether or not it would free up housing, whatever. Who knows? Some people do not want to be in the long-term rental business. Some people prefer the short-term rental business. There is registration acts in some provinces. I know that PEI has taken a different approach altogether. But we're trying to stay on the noise piece of this as well. So let's not confuse the two, but I guess how much time do we want staff to put into this? Are we going down this path? It's $250,000 price tag is what one piece of it I'm hearing for the enforcement piece. And I don't believe that includes the registration piece if we go that route with the short-term rentals. Is that correct?
Yeah. We're just that's a ballpark back of the envelope figure for creating a noise bylaw and having appropriate enforcement for it. And our understanding of how you would go about setting up a licensing regime is your costs would, you would have the similar type of cost because of this staff requirement to run a licensing regime and then follow up with the enforcement side of it.
And I believe that one of the issues that we have, and I know that, Councillor Vino, this is in your area, and it wouldn't change what is happening there because that business currently exists.
You could require a license from existing businesses. You can't tell them they can no longer operate there through a land use bylaw. So the land use bylaw mm-hmm. has the grandfathering effect. The licensing, you would require that of all operators in that type of business activity, even if they're existing now.
But we do not have zoning at this point in that area.
Nope.
So telling people what they can do on their properties or even with, I guess, limiting sound to a certain time frame, do we have that?
Yes.
Without land use planning, can we do that under a registration system?
Yes. So you can make a condition of the license, something related to noise and impact on other properties. And that's where you get into those enforcement costs again.
Yeah.
Because then you have to document that somebody has violated the conditions of their license, and then you have to pursue fines through that and work through that process until you get to the point of possible revocation of their license. Mm-hmm. So that's where your enforcement costs come in, because you're essentially applying the conditions, which are basically noise bylaw conditions, but you're applying them to a licensee.
Yeah.
And so ultimately, staff in reviewing this, we don't feel like this is a better solution for you. It is an option that's available, so we wanted to make sure you had it here. But if we felt that if you're not comfortable pursuing a noise bylaw because of the issues that are around it, it doesn't appear that this is a more appealing approach.
Thank you. Councillor Vino, then Councillor Bell.
Personally, I feel this is a more appealing approach than a noise bylaw, by having a bylaws to regulate business activities, and that's the key word for me here. The short-term rentals and business activities. There's a business in District 10 that operates several times a week, and they are a nuisance to residents that they tell me. This is what I'm hearing. I'm curious, you had mentioned some research in larger cities and some stuff out west. Is there any research that could be done on these specific bylaws, on what they look like for other municipalities, or does the bylaw already have what's required, or do we make it up, such as you mentioned time restrictions and licensing for events? Do we come up with those rules, or are they already in place?
No, the MGA under Section 172 provides broad authority to regulate business activities. So you can't prohibit them, but you can establish conditions around how somebody operates that type of business activity. So, yes, you have the freedom to create them as you like, and we can certainly do jurisdictional scans and explore all types of different regimes that have been put in place, either for venues hosting events or for short-term rentals or for both. That's extensive research that we haven't done, and the fact that you have broader discretion means there's more research and more consultation required.
And just a follow-up comment, while I'm only one voice, I would love to see what that would look like, if there's appetite from other councillors around the table, specifically on the regulating business activities bylaws, not a full noise bylaw. Thank you.
Okay, Councillor Bell.
This issue with short-term rentals has different weights for different districts here. You're talking about 291 rentals, short-term rentals, that you're aware of. I would say that District 2 and District 10 probably have more than 50% of those. If you look at South Cove, there's the amount of rentals around that. I know that in West Dublin alone, I have 40 short-term rentals. In Dublin Shore, there's a large number. And these I've just got to know over the last couple of years. I'm sure there are many that I don't know about. And I'm sure that your area probably has a lot. I'm only speaking for my area. I would say that there's probably some districts that may not have any, unless they have a pristine lake. So when you put a weight on these short-term rentals and say they're taking away from long-term rentals, in many of the cases that I know about in District 2, they would not be suitable for long-term rental because they have amenities that you would not normally have in an apartment. And so trying to regulate them or take them out of business is only one part of the equation. And I want to stress, I appreciate the amount of work that's gone into this, but I think what you have demonstrated is that with the amount of work you've put into this, there's so much more. Mm-hmm. Because how do we bring in a regulation that focuses on, let's say, 12 or 14 communities out of all the communities in MODL? It's the same as municipal roads. There are some councils around here that are so lucky that they don't have a municipal road in their area. They don't understand what can happen in a 24-hour period when the road don't get plowed. We don't have the issues now that we had a few years ago. But if we're going to apply new regulations, I want it to be understood by all councillors, where some of us, like Councillor Vino or myself, we were by the ocean, that it's a different weighted responsibility. I hope I got my message across.
Okay, yes, I understand where you're coming from completely, because there are rentals, short-term rentals, and maybe long-term rentals north of the 103 in places where they're back in the woods. It doesn't matter how much noise they make, no one hears them. So it'd be very hard to put these regulations on something like that. I now have Councillor Greek.
Thank you, Chair. Thanks for looking into this, Alex. Thank you. If we choose to move forward with the licensing, it won't address the noise complaints that I'm hearing from my residents. So I'm cool if we don't move on business-wise. I don't like forming red tape for people trying to provide an income or the short-term rentals. I like less red tape. Anyway, what I'm saying is thank you for looking into this. I appreciate the noise research that has been done. I am the one who originally put it on the agenda long ago, but I don't feel like with all the discussions we had, any route that we go would address the frequent complaints I receive from a few in particular addresses that ongoing.
I have a question, Alex. Through all these discussions that we had, what was the RCMP? If someone's having a party, say in Mountains District, Chassis District, and it's a wedding, it's loud music, and it's bothering the neighbors, under the RCMP Act, what provisions what provisions they have?
So the RCMP have the authority to pursue a charge for example, mischief,
right,
or disturbing the peace.
Right.
Because of they feel that that's a higher bar. You're looking at like criminal type charges. And they feel that they're unlikely to have those heard by a provincial crown prosecutor. Mm-hmm. So they reserve them for that type of charge for where there's other issues going on beyond simply noise. Mm-hmm. You know, if there's altercations that are coming out of that, or threats and that kind of mm-hmm. thing. Just like a ambulance service, they triage their work. So those types of things take a lower precedent than right. more serious risks to public safety. Mm-hmm. So their official position that they've provided to us is that if a noise bylaw were passed, that would be of use to them. It would be another tool in their toolbox. It wouldn't have to rise to the level of criminal mischief, for example, for them to be able to have some kind of enforcement tool where there was an issue. When we did our jurisdictional scan and checked in with other municipalities, the indication is that the resource level with the RCMP is such that they get virtually no assistance mm-hmm. in enforcing a noise bylaw.
Right.
And those municipalities that do have enforcement officers, noise bylaw is only one of the bylaws that they're enforcing, and they generally work business hours, mm-hmm. whereas the noise complaints are happening after hours. Right. So those municipalities that do, for example, the town of Wolfville, mm-hmm. where they have regular party issues with the university mm-hmm. population, they employ some after hours coverage, but they still have difficulty getting resource support from the RCMP,
exactly.
and they encounter the same enforcement mm-hmm. issues.
And also, us putting something in place and costing the taxpayer $250,000 a year, mm-hmm. and they don't have the boots on the ground now to make sure that every issue, every call is answered on the lower level of just nuisance. Mm-hmm. We're just giving them something that they could use, but yet it probably wouldn't even sit in the courts for, it'd probably sit in the courts for like a year before anybody's charged. So like, do we spend that kind of money for something that, and we're almost making ourselves the level of RCMP?
What happens with the municipal bylaw enforcement is that you have to provide the prosecution yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So if someone challenges the summary offense ticket,
mm-hmm.
You have to hope that you get time on the docket after the federal and provincial charges are
right.
dealt with,
yeah.
and you are paying for your own prosecution.
Yeah.
This is not
yeah.
a Crown prosecutor anymore.
Okay. Thank you. I'll be quiet now. So where we go from here, is there any more questions, any more comments? If not, I'm just going to turn it over here to Tom so that he can just wrap everything up.
Yep. So thank you, Madam Chair. So if Council wants us to pursue this as part of the land use planning, no decision has to be made right now. It wouldn't take, it wouldn't become on the work plan of staff until after the Coastal Protection Bylaw is done, which is the end of this year. So we can come back and have these discussions in the future. I think at this point, my sense is that Council isn't asking us to provide any more research on this topic.
Mayor Balifagetson.
I would say that's correct to a certain extent, but it doesn't change the fact the cost to implement. I guess I don't want to spend a lot of time putting it into our land use planning if we have no intentions of putting bylaw enforcement officers in place, because it's the only way that it appears that it's really going to make a difference.
Go ahead.
There needs to be some type of enforcement mechanism there. We can have all the land use planning we want, but if we're not going to enforce it, it doesn't matter. And that's why we see municipalities repealing that piece with noise bylaws, taking it out of their land use, because they can't enforce it.
The land use planning would be more around reducing future conflicting uses rather than around policing noise.
So yeah.
So it is a discussion that
so
you
venues
will
in residential areas,
yeah.
whatever,
yeah.
from that perspective.
Exactly.
Okay, as long as we're not looking at trying to do something here that...
No, trying to pursue...
The enforcement piece, I guess, we have yeah. to come to a decision here on whether or not we want to explore this enforcement bylaw piece and...
And just a refresher on from last month, we wouldn't recommend you pursue enforcement of the noise bylaw on its own. So you would have to develop a noise bylaw, and then we would strongly recommend that you pursue a regional enforcement approach so that you're not trying to bear that cost yourself, you're not trying to provide all of that training yourself, and you're looking at, does this make sense, for example, with MJSB as a shared service where they're doing illegal dumping type enforcement, noise bylaw enforcement, perhaps parks issues. You look at it as a broader service, and it'll be a longer, larger project.
Okay, I have Councillor Haysom, then Councillor Vino.
Thanks. You actually addressed a lot of that. I guess if we're looking at our long-term planning for Modal 2040 and some of those bylaws that might be in place, if it's not, like, are you going to pay $250,000 a year just for noise, but could maybe you wrap in a couple of other different things, maybe animal control or some other services are all fall under that umbrella and could be shared? So you sort of clarified that for me, so thank you. I just don't want to take it off the table altogether because I know that those noise issues are going to come up. They're not always going to be short-term rentals. I'm not interested in getting people to not, you know, do work on their property on the weekend or something. It's not an issue of that. But when I think about those people who came and presented to council about what they are going through every week, multiple times a week, like, it just, we've got to do something for those people. So I maybe this isn't the tool. I want to make sure that we're leaving the door open to say, if there are different ways for us to enforce a variety of bylaws, they don't have to all be done individually. And I think that you answered that question. Thank you.
Perhaps I could hold my question until after a decision was made on this particular piece with a follow-up.
It seems like we have two questions to answer. Do we shelf this for a little bit until after the Coastal Protection Act thing is done and look at it again, or do we just stop right now and just say no more research, we are not interested in a noise bylaw or anything like that? Mayor?
I guess there's a few questions. I don't know if it's only two questions because it's either the Regulation Act, because I just heard what you said, we have to do something for these people. But we've been told that anything that we put in place outside of the registration piece that would regulate the hours or something from a business perspective, and that is that red tape, Michelle, that you spoke against, we would be putting that in place for businesses in our municipality. And it wouldn't only be Airbnbs or wedding venues or whatever, correct? It would be for businesses. Is that what, or are we going to isolate out certain businesses that you cannot make noise? Because we do have businesses that operate in our municipality 24/7.
No,
so we know that.
It would be a licensing system for that type of business. So it would be short-term rentals or venue rentals.
But zoning will not change what is going on in Councillor Vino's district, because it already exists from a zoning perspective or from a land use perspective.
Sorry to keep going back to this. There are two paths.
Yeah.
So the zoning is one path where you try and minimize conflicting uses, and it doesn't go backwards. A venue that's already in place gets to stay in place. The business registration, where you create a licensing regime, targets a particular type of business, you know, like an arcade. There used to be lots of bylaws regulating arcades and amusement halls in municipalities. So you'd be creating a licensing system for short-term rentals, and it would apply to anybody, whether they're operating now or whether they want to operate. You'd have to go through the work of deciding what the conditions of operation would be, and you would be targeting noise during quiet periods as one of the conditions of that licensing.
But with that, we would have to have an enforcement regime
absolutely
to be able to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yep, absolutely. So okay. I guess from a staff perspective, unless there's some other direction, we don't see any further research happening on the regulating business activity or pursuing a noise bylaw. You will be coming back to some of the housing stock question and the conflicting uses as part of your comprehensive land use.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's the direction, staff's recommendation is the direction we will be going in, unless I hear anything different. Councilor Vino.
Another thing happening in District 10 that was kind of twofold when this was brought to council was from the Sawpit Wharf Advisory Committee and the amount of camping that is being done in municipal parks. And without having a bylaw enforcement officer, there's nobody to address that, and the times that this is happening is generally outside of staff time, but I also don't think staff should be going in any case to say, confront people who are camping. So does this also then get the book closed on that as well by dropping this?
The short answer is yes. We aren't pursuing that immediately in the short term. However, it will likely come back to the table as we work through our Recreate Parks project. Right, right now, staff are focused on developing maintenance standards and those quick hit capital improvements. But that is an issue that's cropping up as we engage with the park staff, is that, you know, they are doing some enforcement functions. We don't have a parks bylaw that gives, like, a, for example, a specific set of violations and summary offense tickets that could go along with it, and that might help with the visitor experience that we're trying to achieve. So there's another avenue where that's likely going to come back up on your agenda, but yes, we're saying at this time, no, we're not doing more research on enforcement or noise or business activity regulations.
Okay. So from here, I guess we'll be in the future having a presentation back about the zoning and those kind of regulations. Thank you. Now, do you want a quick break or do you want to do this one last item?
One last item.
Okay. 10.2.2 Housing Accelerator Fund. And who is doing this? And I can't remember her name.
Amy Wombold, our grant coordinator.
She's, yes, our grant coordinator. Yeah. Welcome, Amy.
Thank you. I recognize you're hungry, so I'll try to be succinct. So the Housing Accelerator Fund is a brand new fund that's been announced. It's a federal fund. They're looking at distributing about $4 billion across Canada. It's being, oh, that's horrible. it's being overseen by the Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation. So this fund is a bit different than other funds that we have applied for. The main goal is to increase housing supply across Canada. So this topic links up very nicely with the conversation we just had. We recognize here in the municipality we do have an issue with housing stock. So the way the fund is set up is that the federal government will give us, or any municipality applying for the fund, a financial incentive for creating more housing stock than they were originally planning to create over the next 2 to 3 years. So essentially, whatever we thought we were going to do, if we can do more than that, they're going to give us some pretty hearty incentives to do so. So the way it works is each municipality who wants to apply for the fund has to come up with an action plan. And the action plan essentially looks at what housing stock are we going to be able to do on our own, and what housing stock could we create if we had the additional funding from the federal government. And from that, we can pick out housing supply targets that they're willing to reward us for. So the rewards are pretty great. Essentially, they're looking at us only creating housing other than single family. So we're not going to get any rewards for creating a subdivision with a bunch of single family homes. But other types of housing that's more dense, they will look at rewarding. So the minimum reward we would get for additional housing would be a $20,000 per unit. And there are bonuses in addition to that. So if it's close to transit, if it's affordable, there's a bunch of other conditions. So in looking at this, staff feel it's a great fit for our municipality. It's going to complement existing work plans nicely. And the area that seems to meet what the federal government is hoping to accomplish would be developments within Osprey Village. So staff have contacted a planning consulting firm. I've got to double check their name here. Urban Matters, to help us develop our action plan. It's a very complex document. They're looking at, you know, it's not a visionary document. They're looking at, you know, some hefty planning research to go into that. So they're going to help us come up with our action plan document, which is required in order to apply for the fund. We're going to bring that to council in September or October. That will set the targets that we're hoping to achieve for Osprey Village, which will then give us an idea of how much money we're asking the federal government to contribute to housing development here in our municipality. From there, we'll apply for the fund and see if we are successful. The money that we get from the fund, assuming we are successful, can be used in a variety of ways. There aren't a lot of firm rules around it. So essentially, whatever we feel we need to do to make that housing happen is what we can use the money for. So in Osprey Village, some projects that would jump to mind would be wastewater infrastructure. So investing in our plant, it could be a matter of putting in improved roads, it could be active transportation infrastructure, it could be developer incentives. There's really a lot of flexibility around how we use that money. So the purpose of coming today is just to let council know that we are aware of the fund. We feel it's a good match for our work plans. Mm-hmm. We are putting together the work required to apply for the fund, and we will be bringing the specific information to council about what that means for our municipality in the fall.
Okay. Mayor Bolovgetson.
This is definitely good news, and it's stackable is the piece that I really like, because you can add on the $20,000 per unit, the $15,000 for transit, which we do have now, and also $19,000 if it's affordable. I guess my question is, I know that it can be used, the offset, that's $54,000 a unit. So if we maxed out on it. So if you're looking at $54,000 a unit, we're definitely going to have increased demand on our wastewater treatment plant. We're also going to have to be looking at a water utility or something in this area, so that if it's an accelerated fund, I understand what the federal government is saying. They want it done now. So I want to go back to, how do they know at this point in time, we're negotiating with individuals for parcels of land that could have housing on them. Having said that, is that still available, or is that part of an existing plan that exists now? Because we don't have a lot of land here. We don't have a lot of units yet, but we don't have a lot of land left at this point in time either. So how does this play in, and can we at this point in time say, know what we thought we had a plan for is not what we want. We want to go 20 stories in the air, mm-hmm, instead of four.
So I'll start off with the amount of funding that we can get. There's criteria that we have to meet in order to get the transit pot of money, mm-hmm, or the affordable housing pot of money. So until we delve into those details, I wouldn't want to commit to saying it's going to be $54,000
for each unit. That's the max.
We technically, if we could meet all of the criteria, yeah, we could be looking at that amount of money. I'd probably suggest we're looking at slightly less than that. And it's not per unit we create. I also want to be clear on that. So let's say the municipality is planning on creating 50 units over the next 3 years. That is our base amount that we are going to build. The incentive funding would be if we said, you know what, if we had all of this investment from the federal government, we'd actually be able to probably get 100 units. So we would get funding for the additional 50 units that we're able to create as a result of the fund. So part of the action planning that we're doing with Urban Matters, the planning consulting team, is to look at what is the realistic number for our municipality to say, this is what we're going to be able to do without the fund, and this is what we could do with the fund. That number, we say, like, how will they kind of determine that? It's based on the building permits that are issued between now and that three-year deadline. So we don't actually have to have the units all constructed. That's likely unrealistic, considering that all of our land isn't ready. But we just need to be able to have that building permit issued. So if we say we're going to do, let's say, an additional 50 units, they'll give us money based on how many we are actually able to issue building permits for. And in terms of, like, do we want 20 stories high or whatever else, that goes back into your planning. So the planning that we're planning to do as part of our 2040, we would be looking at developments that are complementary in nature to our existing. So we know we're looking at multi-unit housing. So we would be basing that on what the vision is for planning or for housing in Osprey Village today.
But we can have amendments to our planning strategy as well, because this is a zoned area in this area. So we can go up here without waiting for 2040, if we so wish. Just
yes.
Another question, is the money able to be used to make the units affordable?
I believe the answer would be yes.
But to subsidize the...
There is a provision in there for subsidy. Whatever subsidies we did do would have to be in compliance with the MGA. So staff would have to look to see, you know, what can we actually do. But yes, incentives to developers is one of the categories that we could explore.
Okay.
Hey, are you done? Excuse me, Councillor DeLong, Councillor Staton, Councillor Vino.
Thank you. I'm just curious to know if this is like a competitive grant that we're going to be competing with other municipalities for?
Yes, we'll be competing against municipalities all across Canada.
Okay.
So there's $4 billion to be spread around. And, you know, we're up against cities like Halifax and Toronto. Mm. The good thing is that we're actually quite well positioned to apply. I wouldn't want to promise that we'll get what we ask for, but we are well positioned. It does make sense for us to invest the time in the application.
Okay. Councillor Staton.
Thank you. Some of my questions are answered. So just this fund is you will need a partner to build the units in order to get these funding. You're not suggesting that MODL build units on its own?
No, it would be essentially the same development situation that we have now. What we're looking at doing is making sure that what the developers need to build those units is available. So if, like right now, one of our limitations is wastewater, we can only develop so many units over the next 3 to 5 years because of that capacity. So a fund like this would allow us to say, you know what, we don't have to cap it anymore. We have enough capacity that we could build as much housing as what we think our community needs. Or if a developer said, you know, one of the limitations is the road, you know, we can't afford the road. Well, maybe this would provide us an opportunity to contribute more into the transportation infrastructure. Or if developers were to say, you know, you don't really have the economic conditions here, that I think I could fill houses, so I don't really want to build houses where I know I'm not going to get tenants. What tenants really want is they want transit. So a fund like this would say, oh, well, maybe we would have more money now to invest in a transit system. Does that answer your question?
That part of it does. You kind of scared me there for a minute, and I'm thinking the last thing this municipal government needs is to get into housing, because I have a little experience, and I'm telling you, it's a hole you don't want to go down.
No, we're looking at using the money for the conditions that we're able to control as a municipal government in the services that we're currently offering, or the services that council would like to offer in the future.
So you need a partner to join you when you get the funding, you need to have a partner to take advantage of that funding.
Yes, and we currently have partners that we're working with, which makes sense for us. So, like, an example of how we could use this fund, just an example, we have a lot of land, a lot, not a single lot, here in Osprey Village that doesn't have a lot of potential for development because there's a water course on it. And maybe developers don't want to take on the hassle of dealing with a water course. We could use a fund like this to make that lot development ready. So somebody coming in, it's a quicker and easier project for them just to come in and do their housing development. So that's an example of how we could work in partnership with somebody who want to build houses within our municipality.
Okay. And I have Councillor Vino, then Councillor Hobley, Deputy Mayor Hobley.
My question was answered through other councillors. Okay. Thank you.
Deputy Mayor Hobley.
So this doesn't apply to anything existing. So it wouldn't apply to Stone Mount because it's already started. What about FH development where it's not started?
It does go back till April 2022. So we can backdate. So Stone Mount, I don't know if there's a portion of that building that could potentially...
The first unit, building right. permit was applied for before that. The second one that they've started construction on, we think falls after the date. So
it's the date of the building permit?
Yep.
Yes.
So anything FH development has planned would fall under this?
Absolutely.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Excellent. So it's a matter for us to determine
excellent.
What we consider already going to happen versus what's new because of the fund. And staff will be working out that ratio for council with working with our urban matters planning consultants.
Awesome. Thank you.
Okay, Councillor DeLong.
If you already answered this, I missed it. When does the application period end?
They don't have it open yet. So there's been a lot of media warning us that it's going to open. It's going to be open for 45 days, and that's it. So we're doing our work now preemptively because we expect that it will be open this summer is the window we've been provided. But when it is announced, which we expect in the coming weeks, it'll be open for 45 days and then it'll be closed.
Okay. Thank you. Anybody else?
No?
Just go ahead.
If you don't mind, sorry. The consulting firm that you have engaged, Urban Matters, they're coming back to us with information in September. Is that what you said?
They're working collaboratively with staff on developing the action plan, which is the bulk of what the application actually is. And it's part of the application. Council must approve that action plan. So, yes, that will be coming to council. Council does not have to approve it before we apply. So if the windows, depending how those windows work out, the application could technically go in without council looking at it, although we would certainly prefer council to look at the action plan before it went in. But council must approve the action plan before we sign any agreements to receive the money.
Okay, thank you.
All right. So I guess we're all going to be looking. Okay, Councillor Staten.
Just one quick question. I think we should see the action plan before it goes in. And my question for you is, if someone other than outside of Osprey Village where the water and sewer lines have not been extended, and someone came along and said, oh, I have a plan for X number of units, can this fund be used to extend the water and sewer lines? Could that be used for that purpose? Say back to Pine Grove or up here at Wynette Road or somewhere.
Not single unit.
No. I'm talking multi-units. Could that money be used for us to extend the water and sewer lines to those land so it could be used for that purpose?
Theoretically, yes.
Okay.
But we're also, for this application, looking at development that's realistic within that three-year window. So a project like that would probably make more sense for a future call, assuming that there are future calls for this funding.
Don't rule it out. That's all I'm saying.
Okay. Thank you, Amy. So we will look forward to that action plan coming back so council can take a look and approve it. Thank you. It looks like that's the end of our agenda. Is it? Yep. Motion to adjourn. Moved by Councillor DeLong, seconded by Councillor Haysom. All those in favor? Motion carried unanimously. We are now adjourned. Before everyone runs out the door, do you have a half hour? Sure. Take a break and then come back. CTJ, no staff. Except for Tom.